Hi, thank you very much for your flexibility with this seminar and the schedule. My apologies for the sudden notice. Everything is back to great on my end, and I appreciate your understanding. We're talking about the neuroscience of peak performance in this seminar, specifically beginning with a confidence blueprint. And I want to emphasize again as a sidebar here, thank you for your notes and responses to the questions, suggestions about what you'd like to incorporate, and I will work in those responses in my discussion. So it may vary a little bit from the outline you have, but I'll be sticking to the essentials of that, but I want to incorporate responses to your questions and the things you've mentioned, and I appreciate that very much. Olympic gold medalist Nuruddin Marcelli of Algeria said, "When I race, my mind is full of doubts. Who will finish second? Who will finish third?" Dr. Denton Cooley, a medical colleague in Houston, offered his version. "When you're asked to name the three top surgeons in the world, you should probably have trouble thinking of the other two." Now, that may be an overabundance of confidence, but neuroscience does show that the state of mind of confidence is more correlated with success than competence or expertise. Confidence is a state of mind. It's both art and neuroscience, and it initiates access to the mindset containing the necessary skills that are established in deliberate practice. We'll come back to that too. Now, here's a simple illustration. David Scott Yeager assigned 44 seventh grade students to write an essay about a personal hero. The teachers marked the essays and provided written feedback. They divided the essays, researchers did, into two piles. In one, they added a generic note in the teacher's handwriting saying, "I'm giving you these comments so that you'll have feedback on your paper." The essays in the second pile received a note saying, "I'm giving you these comments because I have very high expectations and I know you can reach them." For those who received the generic note, 40% revised their papers. For those who received the encouraging high expectation notes, 80% revised their papers and made more than twice as many corrections and additions as the first group. Confidence, like any state of mind, is contagious. Beliefs are a feeling of certainty about what something means. When you have a certainty, your brain will find a way. Now, this is now demonstrated in brain studies. Belief in someone transforms a state of mind in that recipient to a more creative, integrative state. Think about how important that can be with your client and reflect on how that has happened with you and your expectations and beliefs in a client, how they've lived into it. Success most often has to do with two things. The state of mind of confidence that we engage in endeavor, and then how we manage an optimum performance state under pressure and the circumstances that impinge on that. Confidence is a belief that you can create a successful outcome through your action. It's initially subjective. It's an emotional regard of a promise that you then live into. Confidence is an internal sense that I can make this work. Whereas optimism is the belief everything will work out. Confidence projects competence in a number of studies of practicing experts and their recommendations. One of my favorite sayings is, "Fate whispered to the warrior, 'You cannot withstand the storm.' The warrior whispered back, 'I am the storm.'" This is a mantra that I had, and found necessary. My daughter wanted me to join her to run a portion of the Boston Marathon with her from the day she was in college there. And she finally realized that she had to qualify and get a sponsor. So many years later, she got sponsorship, had the times. After her doctorate, she moved back to Boston to practice, and it became a reality to my horror when she qualified and obtained sponsorship. And I was excited and horrified at the same time, kind of blended together. While I'm a lifetime athlete, distance running is not my thing, and running has always been in relation to some ball. So I knew I would have to find some way to sustain focus and tolerate the rigors and pain of training to cross the finish line together. So that was my mantra. I am the storm. It instantly transported me into a state of mind that transcended any kind of other focus or even any pain or fatigue. So many I am the storms later, we crossed the finish line shoulder to shoulder. So I say that to ask, how does that work? Now, the brain chemistry that establishes optimum confidence is led by serotonin, the chemical messenger that helps us remain calm and make rational choices. Confidence establishes ample serotonin in the prefrontal cortex, the command center of the brain for rational thought and decision making. Now, in brain chemistry, there's an inverse ratio of stress and confidence. With psychological threat and anxiety, the challenge is to regulate state of mind, to manage serotonin, and sustain confidence. It's a balance. Another transmitter that directly affects confidence is oxytocin. This mediating chemical of bonding and connection fosters an internal mindset of confidence. The connection can be to important others or to an internal ideal. Here's a related application. Neuroscience research shows that the first words spoken in a conversation trigger a neurochemical reaction in the listener that then boots up a specific mindset. And that mindset then processes the remainder of the conversation to determine meaning and significance. Now, this is huge for any leader, from business to sports to parenting to mentor coaching. Here's an illustration of that from these studies. A conversation that begins with remarks that are perceived, experienced as authoritative, critical, adversarial, activates the brain's defensive circuitry of fight, flight, or freeze, the stress chemicals, cortisol, and adrenaline. The listener experiences some degree of guardedness, anxiety, maybe distrust, and closes down for self-protection. The subsequent conversation is then processed through that mindset. Now, back to the beginning. On the other hand, a conversation that begins in a collaborative mode activates oxytocin, the brain's neurochemical system related to bonding and connection. This initial perception of a collaborative, trusting discussion induces a desire to listen without judgment and pay full attention, and it frames the remainder of the conversation for the listener, for the receiver. The listener feels safe, heard, understood. Trust develops with openness to further collaboration to optimize performance and results. And think about how this informs the framework we engage a mentor coaching client to have that collaborative mindset to look together at what can be of help to that client. Building confidence requires, even demands, hard work, risk, persistence, even tolerating failure. Gaining confidence regularly means going outside a comfort zone and tolerating setbacks with determination and resilience. Comfortable and confident are not prerequisites, but the result of effective engagement. In fact, limiting assumptions include, I need to feel comfortable before I really do this. I need to feel confident before I can engage. I need to have experience before I can initiate. So how can you prime your mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation and establish a mindset of confidence? First, let's look at how not to do it. This is from Alexander Wolfe in Sports Illustrated. By yelling at his point guard for missing that wide-open teammate in the corner, that coach is probably ensured that it will happen again. And think about how this is a common assumption, that the best way to get employees or players or colleagues to perform is by pointing out mistakes, even making threats, or being intense, not to mention parenting. While negative emotions grab attention, a positive focus works considerably better to establish an engaging mindset, to develop confidence and the associated aspects of loyalty, bonding, personal development, commitment to a group. Priming of mind and brain to prepare for an anticipated situation establishes the foundation of a mindset of confidence. You'll see in the outline 7 strategies for successful priming for confidence. It can include, and I just want to highlight a few of these without going through them. They're in the outline. Establish a positive, powerful framework that induces serotonin. It may be a powerful question to ask yourself. Identify moments of significant success where you had a feeling of, I can do it, or whatever it takes. Perhaps mental imagery of the successful completion of the endeavor. For those of you who have played the game Taboo, you have in that game a target word on a card that you draw that you want your partner to say, given your single word clues without any gestures. Always hard for me. Also on that card with the target word at top are a half dozen words that you cannot use, the words that would make it too easy, and you lose the point if you say the taboo word. So think about how hard it is once you've seen those 6 words to not say one of those words, because your focus has already become anchored to those words that you cannot say. If you say one of those 6 taboo words, you lose the point. So often, what you shouldn't say can frame and even dominate thinking to make it hard to get beyond those taboo words to offer reasonable clues. People who have more comfort and confidence to go further when they carry the best parts of themselves forward. Appreciative inquiry, a whole body of work and application looks at how a person or organization can study and define the best parts there are, and then use that information to build on what's already working. Dr. Diana Whitney is the founder of this whole field of appreciative inquiry. She was a guest in my mastermind group. She describes, just in brief summary, systematic studies of appreciative inquiry that show 3 major aspects, and listen for the application in coaching. Focus on what works enhances what works. Ask about what you want more of rather than about problems and barriers. Focus becomes a reality. A focus on possibility creates a positive mindset. Focus on problems elicits a problem mindset. And appreciative inquiry awakens possibility to create an aha experience. Here's an example of that set of ideas applied. Dr. David Copperwriter found that asking about problems in a usual consultant role, half of the organizations he did the usual consultant role, asking about a problem, solving the problems. And the other half, he asked about possibility or opportunity. This created a success mindset, and the groups where he did this approach and framed it in this way were significantly more satisfied and felt they got significantly further in positive planning than looking at and solving problems. A head athletic coach who attempted to lead his team to victory told him, "I know what it takes to win games. I know how to condition the players and to map game strategy. I lead the team by letting each player know what I expect of them and exactly what to do." Now, unfortunately, that didn't work. The result was the team was not even close to peak performance and winning team mindset and results. The coach couldn't understand why his players were not taking his directives. The outstanding athletes did not feel valued or respected, but felt judged and criticized. How you engage establishes a context. The framework of asking someone is the antithesis of telling, of giving information, of data. Giving information has never changed anyone's mind. And what we know, people will commit to what they co-create. Think about this in the coaching context from the very beginning. What do you want to focus on? Where do you want to get to? So, let's apply this really to mindfulness training and peak practice. When Phil Jackson introduced mindfulness meditation after taking over as head coach of the Chicago Bulls, they won 6 NBA championships. Then, as coach of the LA Lakers, he again introduced mindfulness meditation to his team. They won 5 NBA championships. And he was known when he called a timeout not to give information or instruction, but simply to tell a brief story that was a Native American story, or just simply to talk about something that the team engaged in rather than instruction of what to do. The tens of thousands of hours that they had each practiced, they didn't need more data or information. They needed simply to focus and come together as a team in this moment. In a study in the Journal of Cognitive Enhancement, researchers at the University of Miami found that expert athletes who practiced mindfulness for 12 to 15 minutes a day were significantly more able to withstand emotional and mental demands of physical training, had greater resilience, and more sustained focus. The essential simplicity of meditation is to focus on one thing, such as your breath, to breathe in relaxation, to breathe out tension, and give full focus on that specific thing. When your mind wanders, which it will, because that's the job description of the brain, notice that, let it go, and move back to the focus on breathing. Being aware of this process is a kind of way of being aware of awareness. This selective attention aligns the energy field of your brain. It's a model some of you have heard me talk about, some of you repeatedly. As you know, I'm not above being redundant. This is a model for listening as a coach. We are totally attuned. We are grounded and centered, ideally, and totally attuned to our client, our client's story. Anything else, if we wonder what we should say or think about something else or get just refocus on the client's story and developing that from the client's point of reference. There's a brief mindfulness meditation in the outline. that I won't go over again, but just perhaps to use as reference, you probably have your own way, a favorite way of doing that. Consider, then, ending the meditation with a specific gratitude, something you're grateful for in present time as you're aware of this relaxed state of your body and the focus and steadiness of your mind. Open your eyes and gradually come back then to focus on present awareness. In a number of studies, a focus on gratitude boosts energy level, can enhance resilience, and increases beneficial hormones in the body, and two specific immunoglobulins are enhanced by this process. This mindfulness training can be a specific, deliberate practice component for optimum performance. Physiological changes in the brain with these practices have been shown to generate faster learning, decrease stress, and enhance performance. So, a question. Are you getting better at the things you most care about? Or are you not improving much at things that matter to you despite spending a lot of time working hard on them? Prevailing theory for decades was that experience was the key to expertise. The more somebody practiced, the more expert they became. 10,000 hours to develop significant expertise. Yet compelling research shows that we don't gain experience from experience alone. Dr. Anders Ericsson has spent his professional lifetime studying the elements of experts as they become experts. He studied the art and science of how someone practices to become an expert for what they do to perform exceptionally. The answer is deliberate practice. Research reveals, and here's a zinger for that. Research reveals that after the initial couple of years in a profession, performance can plateau. This is usually a result of movement away from time in the learning zone to focus more and more time on the performance and the performance zone. For example, older and more experienced physicians paradoxically can perform worse than younger, less experienced colleagues. The reason? The documented finding is initially not obvious. While the younger physicians have received more current knowledge and training in school, continuing education of experienced physicians should bridge that gap, and the gap should be further widened by the years of experience in the trenches. But this isn't the case. What's missing, as we know now, is deliberate practice. A conclusion reached by Ericsson and his colleagues is that, with few exceptions, people don't gain experience from experience alone. Experience doesn't make an expert. How someone practices informs how someone performs. The vast majority of learning and growing occurs during practice, not during performance. Intense focus on crafting a specific goal with openness for input from a mentor coach, for example, proves significantly more effective than massive repetition at regular practice. With artists, intellectuals, athletes, professionals, consistent findings was that neither experience nor practice was the crucial variable. Deliberate practice was. So expertise is not about the total number of hours of practice, as in the 10,000-hour rule, but the type of practice that fills those hours makes the big difference. For example, Ericsson and his team found the number of years of practice had no correlation with how successful a clinical psychologist was with patients. He found that in a number of instances, significant expertise, such as physics professors and practicing physicians, do not do as well as newcomers in their respective areas. Repetition of the same experience is different from deliberate practice focused on improving and a growth mindset. In fact, practice itself can make you worse. Think about every shot that misses its mark makes your aim worse. This is the neuroscience of deliberate practice. The creation of muscle memory is a process of myelinization, of rewiring your brain. Repetition of specific intended motor skills requires that each time over and over, it becomes faster, easier, smoother. The drawback is that a skill performed in the wrong way can also be hardwired. So the solution is not to try harder, but to try differently. For example, to approach a barrier from a different direction, such as to work with a teacher or a coach, someone who's familiar with the obstacles and can suggest ways to overcome them, to have the openness of a growth mindset. A couple of challenges in changing any behavior is the mind's inclination to create certainty by repetition of the known outcome. This is a bias to want immediate closure and predictability, even if it's not the result you want. And the brain is wired to repeat behavior and has an error detection mechanism that alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. Even if the change is good, it's still resisted and there's still a signal of this isn't what I expected. So I want to reference the outline to look at the specifics of the characteristics of the learning zone where the goal is to improve, to concentrate on what you want to master, expect to make mistakes, learn from them. And deliberate practice occurs in this learning zone, not in a performance zone. And in a performance zone, the goal is to do something as best as possible, to execute what's been practiced. The learning zone maximizes growth and future performance. The performance zone maximizes immediate performance. So to say that just a bit more simply, practice doesn't make perfect. Practice makes permanent. Only perfect practice makes perfect performance. The right kind of practice carried out over a sufficient period of time leads to improvement. Deliberate practice is significantly more important in performance than predefined talent or ability. Only deliberate practice with expert information and mentoring, for example, as a kind of threat, will result in enhancing expertise and developing skill. Deliberate practice modifies the structure and the function of the brain, and it increases the ability to perform skillfully. I'll reference the outline for the 7 framework principles of developing significant skills with deliberate practice. And the essence is to focus on one thing, to look at the goal and the next step for this one thing, and look at ways of measuring when you create this map. Again, think of the analogy of the simple coaching model. Here's one illustration of that. New York Times multiple bestseller Jeanine Roth, whose work I admire, was an expert content contributor in my mastermind group. In response to one of the questions about writing her, but she has multiple bestsellers on the New York Times, she said, and she and I are buddies, and I'd never heard this from her. She said that she never lets any of her writing to be seen by anyone else until she has done at least 30 edits. Each edit improves, refines, focuses. And as part of this process, she gets feedback from savvy readers. I'm fortunate enough to have been one. So this is an illustration of deliberate practice. and an application. Here's another example from a different perspective, deliberate practice and mental representations, because that's what deliberate practice does, is develop the models in our brain to synthesize without having to think about it, the actions and responses. 100 CEOs were interviewed by Accenture to determine the skills needed for executive success. Of 14 abilities that were crystallized from these interviews, one particular ability summarized the best of the characteristics that made a difference: self-awareness. Self-awareness is the foundation of all deliberate practice. To know to ask is half the answer. To be able to reflect on oneself and performance requires this ability to be attuned to all levels of self and performance, to incorporate the flexibility of taking in new information in order to change. This is exactly what we catalyze with our clients and hopefully with ourselves in our own growth and work. Self-awareness is a particular system's understanding of the self, to look both subjectively and objectively at patterns of emotion, behavior, attachment, including communication, as we talked moments ago. The ability to see oneself, to recognize patterns, to think systemically, are important aspects of understanding our own dynamics and the dynamics of others. So, this component of deliberate practice to develop a corresponding mental representation of the specific process and structure of performance is a fundamental aspect of the neuroscience of performance. Mental representations allow you to see meaningful patterns and live into them. Deliberate practice develops these mental representations to enhance and perfect performance and form the foundation of revising this internal model in an ongoing way to incorporate changes to make them permanent. 5 questions for each performance goal you set. Is your goal specific? Is it measurable? Is your goal positive? Is your goal inspiring to you? And is your goal displayed? Does it find representation in how you think about it, how you behave, even how you write it down? Erickson emphasized that the central purpose of deliberate practice is to develop mental representations that organize the execution of skills. And deliberate practice is designed to make these representations improve over time. So think about one other thing in regard to this. Do you remember a specific moment in a performance you did, or anything where your performance with a client, a presentation, a peak experience is a personal moment of lasting positive feeling, an exciting and fulfilling high point of an instance that's usually intense and meaningful? These flashbulb moments of personal high points of maybe exciting and fulfilling experience can serve as an exemplary moment, a positive representation, and highlight a career or an entire set of experiences. These instances can serve as an organizer and motivator for other performance-based activities. So peak experiences, like peak performances, are most likely to occur in a state of flow. That's a sustained state of mind, of access to a whole practice and performance mindset. What's developed in deliberate practice so that it can be automatic in performance. Flow is described as being in the zone, in the state of mind, an ideal mental state for a specific activity with full access to all the developmental and developed skills, as well as the experience of enjoyment. Flow is in itself rewarding, it's pleasurable, internally motivated. Think about the last time you had this experience with a client where you were so in tune, so present, and focused on the client and the development of the story. Then when either of you or both of you together usually has a moment of insight, an aha experience, three different parts of your brain light up at that moment. And you're vaulted into a state of mind that's more synthetic and integrative and creative. And states of mind are contagious. They are contagious faster than the fastest of viruses. This happens especially when you're not distracted by a video conference session. It can happen very readily by telephone. It can happen in person. Whatever your mode, the attunement is what's important. Here's one instance that I want to share with you. This is a study I think was designed for professional coaches without the scientists even being aware at the time of professional coaching. Ben Fletcher at the University of Hertfordshire in the UK devised a study to get people to break their usual habits. Each day, the subjects picked a different option from poles of contrasting behavior that were given by the study people. They would choose between lively, quiet, introvert, extrovert, reactive, proactive, talk about business, talk about sport. They would pick one and behave according to this assignment for the entire day. So, for example, an introverted person would act as an extrovert for an entire day. Additionally, twice weekly, they had to stretch to behave in a way outside their usual pattern. They would twice a week eat something they had never eaten before and read something twice a week they would have never read before. So, what do you think the primary finding of the researchers were? The primary change in this group of people studied? The remarkable finding, in many ways, was that after 4 months, the subjects lost an average of 11 pounds. 6 months later, almost all had kept the weight off. The weight loss impact, this was not a diet, they weren't studying diets. It was a result of the study focusing on change and its impact. And it's one that I would call a focus on choice architecture. What they did was to request that people focus on doing something different than they had ordinarily done. This takes it out of the automatic mode to really make it more conscious and more focused. When they ate something they had never eaten before, they began to really think about it instead of just eating automatically, taking a bite or two, enjoying the taste, and then kind of zoning into some other kind of focus. Instead, they focused on what they were eating. They even began to ask two questions. Is this food in my best interest? Most also came to ask, is this bite in my best interest? So they chose foods that were healthier and to not eat beyond what was in their best interest, resulting in the weight loss and the ongoing weight loss, because this had become a process of looking at the choice architecture of simple things that they hadn't really paid attention to before. This is exactly what we do in coaching. We focus on this moment, on what is the choice the client is making this moment to enhance the best choice given the situation, to not do something automatically. We may highlight if there are unconscious or other kinds of biases are the automatic kind of responses that may be limiting by looking consciously, specifically, focused on the chart architecture of this moment. And the principle is that whatever we think, believe, and experience are what we create each moment. And as we're aware of that, we can probably make better choices. So think about how a habit just simply engages software created for past experience. It's useful. It can tremendously expedite the default and effortless execution. If it's no longer useful and outdated, then a new behavior pattern needs to be created. So a simple strategy then becomes not to fight old habits, but simply to start a new one. The choice architecture: is this bite in my best interest? All the associations of the past habit then are instantly replaced by an immersion in the current focus and the mindset of the choice architecture of this moment, this choice. Our habits have become invisible to us, so we have to become then mindful of our choices and the active process of choice in everything we do. So that means we have to keep unlearning just as we keep learning to convert the mindlessness of automaticity into the mindfulness of change and the choice architecture of this moment. So the ability to unlearn includes strategically not engaging a default pattern or connection, to quickly disengage it if it automatically recurs. A new behavior needs to be side by side with this unlearning to gradually phase out the old behavior, the habit, and the neural wiring that's with it. So being aware is always the first step to recognize the authorship and own the story we create at this moment. Here's something that may be helpful to you in working with clients, particularly when they have, negative self-talk, negative thoughts that seem instantly booted up, an old story of feeling bad about something. Three simple steps for self-directed neuroplasticity, how to change the brain. And this involves unlearning and learning all combined. First is to recognize the error message in your brain. That negative self-talk, the negative thoughts, that comes from a time capsule that probably resulted from stopping yourself in this moment. That old mindset instantly booted up. So recognize the error message from your brain to be able to reframe it. Second step, reframe to a present focus and experience of challenge, of opportunity. What's then the refocus to the next step? So to recognize the error message, to reframe as a false brain message, and to reframe it specifically to a positive experience or challenge, and then refocus on the next step for this new possibility. When we unlearn connections and associations, we weaken the chemical connections between neurons, which is also neuroplasticity. To unlearn is neuroplasticity as well, just in the opposite direction of learning. This unlearning is necessary in our neural networks to create room for new connections. The combination of strengthening some connections, learning, while weakening others, unlearning, keep our neural networks from overload. This pruning of the old unused pathway occurs up to 60% during our sleep. This is how we can wake up from a good night's rest and think perhaps more clearly or quickly about something. And keep in mind two things. Some problems are better avoided than solved. Some problems you can't solve, you just have to outlive. Now, we'll go into the how-to in the seminar 3 that we'll talk about next week to incorporate the roadmap system as a strategic way to deconstruct and understand personal performance, to systematically write new code for mind, brain, and behavior, and to perform under pressure. So, just a brief word about the output channel. And think about when you ask your client at the end of the session, would you say what the most important thing is you're taking away from our discussion today? You're asking them to conceptualize it and put it in an output channel. What value does that have? Well, if you were to take a test on a paper, 8 pages in length, which of these methods would result in the greatest success? Reading those 8 pages 4 times in a row, trying to memorize them, or reading 8 pages once, putting down the paper and writing a brief summary. Research shows that the second strategy of putting knowledge into action result in a 50% greater success. Here's an even simpler example. University of Waterloo did a study where a number of volunteers read the same passage in a book, half read it out loud, half read it silently. They were all then given the same test. The ones who read it out loud did 40% better on the test. They had put it in an output channel. So it completed a circuit in their brain and made it more attainable and more memorable. So one thing that is a kind of overview of this, cognitive skills like reading and vocabulary, as well as other mental and physical development, stimulates myelin growth, as we talked about moments ago. Myelin grows when you actually practice to activate nerve stimulation for the development. So practice, rather than making perfect, makes myelin. When practice is deliberate and informed, specific skills develop and become hardwired. Every skill is a form of memory. And every form of memory is enhanced by focused, systematic practice. Think about this as just another way of conceptualizing what you do individually with each of your clients. The process of this deliberate practice facilitates both attention and retention. It makes it your story. A body in motion tends to stay in motion. A body at rest tends to stay at rest. That's how we're wired. So you have to have a plan and a strategy, systematic, step-by-step, for change. Since the brain hardwires what we repeatedly do, good or bad, when we attempt to change, our brains and our minds resist, and the error detection mechanism activates to say, this isn't what we expected. So this brain error detection mechanism alerts to anything other than repetition of the familiar. So, again, everything we've talked about is in the outline to look at, to reflect on. If there are questions or clarification, feel free to email me or mention them at the beginning of our next seminar. Thanks again for the flexibility here. I hope you found this helpful, and I'm very eager to hear your take on this and any questions or clarifications you have. I look forward to our next collaboration at our regular time Monday. Thanks very, very much.